From the Theater Talk studio at WBFO, this is Press Pass. I'm Mark Scott, joined by Buffalo Spree editor Elizabeth Licata.
Hello, Mark.
How are you?
I'm great. Happy fall.
Yes, it's been a nice fall, a little on the cool side the last couple of weeks. Well, the November issue of Buffalo Spree arrives in subscribers' mailboxes this week, and readers will be introduced to Western New York's Women of Food. How well represented are women in Buffalo's food and beverage industry?
It depends on what you're looking for. We're extremely well represented in all areas except, I would say, head chef. We have a lot of women owners. I mean, that's right at the top. We have women servers. We have a lot of women pastry chefs. We have women front of the house managers. We have women brewers, you know. We have all kinds of artisans of food. We have women making kombucha and other, you know, pickled things. And we have some, like, women running some really great businesses, like Bread Hive and of course, Gypsy Parlor. And so I think on one hand, we're really well represented. On another hand, maybe we would like to see more of our chefs. It's just that I think that's a tough job for anybody. And as I pointed out in my letter, I don't know if you saw that. I don't think you did. The pay is terrible for men and women. So if it's bad for men, it's got to be even worse for women.
Well, the one takeaway I did take from the special section is that all of these women do work hard, and they all have a passion for what
they're
doing.
And that's what makes it really interesting, is that they love what they're doing, even though it is really hard, grueling hours. You know, even when you're not the chef, it's just any kind of restaurant work is grueling hours and requires the utmost in dedication. And they're really fun people.
Another interesting takeaway is that some of the women were trained at prestigious culinary schools, while others are receiving on-the-job training.
And that has been, actually, you know, the first training, if you go back to France, the training always was on-the-job. On-the-job training has a very long tradition. So you couldn't really say there's a hierarchy between going to, say, a culinary school and on-the-job training. They're both great. They're different. You might come away with different things from them, but, you know, both excellent ways to enter the field.
One of the women you profile I consider a pioneer, and that's Prish Moran, the founder of Sweetness 7.
Yes.
She helped lead a transformation of a neighborhood by converting an old building headed for demolition into one of the city's most popular cafes.
Well, I think there's a lot of, it's interesting. Prish really is coming from the development role because she has no background or training in food. And I think there's a lot of people like her throughout Buffalo who you don't hear about You hear about the Benderson, the Sinatra, the Ellicott and all that. But these are people who are just buying up a few properties and doing amazing things with them. Prish is one of those people. And she has created this great center of activity with Sweetness 7 and continues to add on to it.
And then there are the operators of the soup food truck. And I just think a food truck is so challenging. I mean,
that's
I look at
really
the chef's
hard.
Truck. It was destroyed by fire. And then I went to a fundraiser last week for the daily bread food truck operated by a local church. And it's just such a challenge to keep these things
on
the road.
There's so much there that you have to have everything that you need in the truck. If you don't have it, you better figure out what to do. And you can't possibly have all the resources that you have in a brick-and-mortar operation in a truck. And what you do find is a lot of people move from trucks to brick-and-mortar for that reason, although I'm not saying that that's what will happen here. But it's great to have a soup food truck, and they seem like really fun people.
Also in the November issue, you write about a new exhibit at the Albright Knox Art Gallery titled Giant Steps. Now, it explores pop art of the 1960s, and I was reading in your article that was a very transitional period in art history as normal conventions were being discarded.
Yeah, it's a really fun period. And I mean, I'm going to break away from that aspect of it a little bit just to say, just go to this just to see artwork that you've probably never seen. It really showcases, all of these collection shows showcase the amazing breadth, depth of the collection there, things that they absolutely never can't show all the time. I know I saw at least 10 or more works that I've never seen on display, and some of them I wonder if they've ever been. Like, for example, a Marisol work that they just acquired because she recently died, and the artist gifted her entire estate to the Albright Knox. But yes, it was a time of great transition, and you had all these sorts. It wasn't just pop art, though. There was minimalism was going on. And then there was all these, the Zero Group. And then there were artists who were really interested with movement, using technology, you know, in ways in artworks. And there's one of the works is you put on headphones and listen to music while you're watching it. Some of the works you can touch. So it's just a really, and some of them revolve. So very tumultuous time, the 60s, and I think the art of that time reflects that.
Now, the exhibit is titled Giant Steps, and that is also the name of one of jazz great John Coltrane's most influential albums. Is there a link between that album and the works of art on display?
You couldn't tell by me. I love jazz. I love jazz of that era, and the great era of jazz, in my view, is between 1955 and 1965. But how the development of improvisational jazz meshes with the development of modernist movements in art, that's a little beyond me. And as I say in my review, you really need to ask Doug Dreispoon about that, who is the emeritus curator and is a jazz musician as well as an art curator. So I'm sure he's got all that down. You'll have to have him on.
The November issue also marks the beginning of a partnership between Buffalo Spree and Investigative Post, which also partners with us here at WBFO. Yes. Now, its editor, Jim Heaney, writes about the obstacles reporters face in trying to get information from all levels of government. And it got me thinking, he's right. It truly has evolved from a time when we could walk into Mayor Masiello's office in City Hall.
I have walked into Mayor Masiello's office.
Yeah. To today, where you're forced to go through the public information officer.
Yeah, it has changed a lot. And to show you the minuteness of this, I belong to a block club, the North Pearl Block Club, and we wanted to get in touch with other block club leaders throughout the city. And so my husband, the city has a list of all the block clubs and who leads them. And my husband contacted them for this and was told he would have to file an FOI report for block club leaders.
So even the average citizen is having to use the FOI to get documents.
Yeah, and of course, with reporters, they're dealing with much more higher-level stuff than that. And they're, you know, and this is just, I think you see the stonewalling all the way up, you know, to Washington and you know, throughout the U.S.
So we can expect this kind of coverage from Jim in future months?
I can hardly wait to see what Jim is going to be bringing us. He hasn't had his this Outrages and Insights column in print for quite some time, maybe as much as 10 years. And so it'll be interesting to see what he takes up. It'll be different than the kind of Investigative Post stories that you guys work with. As you do work with breaking news, you can. We can't as much. So with them, they're bringing like new discoveries to you. With Jim, I believe he'll be writing about more general trends that are happening, you know, in the field of reporting, in the field of politics. So I think it'll be really great.
There's also an interesting article about Bills rookie quarterback Josh Allen, and he's now sidelined with an injury, and the Bills quarterback situation is as bad as it's ever been since exactly 50 years ago, when Ed Rutkowski was forced into action as a disaster quarterback when I was a kid in 1968. And I just see such parallels between 68 and 2018.
Wow.
We had a rookie quarterback back then named Dan Dara, and he got injured. The veteran, Jack Kemp, was out back then. And eventually, as I said, Ed Rutkowski had to come in. He was a wide receiver and play quarterback. And this year, Allen's injured. Peterman can't play. And we got this guy who was started four games in the last 8 years who is now the starting quarterback for the Bills. It's any thoughts from you as a casual fan?
Well, I only know what I read in the column. I mean, it doesn't look good for the Bills I can tell, but I think that our columnist Peter Martin brings up some important points about, and this is true in all life, that the quarterback must have the support of his offensive line, and that you've got to have a great offensive line for any quarterback, no matter how great they are or supposed to be or reported to be. So and I think that's true in any job.
And he needs
field.
Receivers too, because they're not catching the ball.
Everybody,
we might not be able to really evaluate him until they get some players here.
Well, I'll look to you to give
to keep you informed on that. Along with your columnist.
Yes, yes, and Peter too.
Elizabeth, thanks for coming in.
Thank you, Mark.
Elizabeth Licata is editor of Buffalo Spree. Mark Scott, WBFO News.